Financial support for WICN and programs like Inquiry come from listeners like yourself. So plan to take a moment out to consider becoming a member now by pledging online to WICN at wicn.org. Thank you. Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Christina Rice. She's a librarian and a writer. She oversees the photo collection at the Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. And we're talking about her book, Anne Dvorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel. Christina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. You wouldn't be the first one to call me Anne.
I know. Well, this is, we were just talking off mic, this is one of the most unusual Hollywood biographies I think I've read, because she is such an unusual person, both good and bad.
Going into it, I wasn't expecting to find out the things that I found out about Anne.
Well, what attracted you to her? Because, you know, most people have never even heard of Anne Dvorak today.
Yeah. It started like around 1995. I was in college, and I've always been a movie fan since I was really young. And I checked out a movie called Three on a Match from my local library, and I just thought it was going to be a fun, quick, lurid, pre-code film with sex and drugs and Betty Davis. And I watched it, and there was Anne, and I'd never heard of her before. And her performance in that movie as a society woman who throws it all away for sex and drugs, and her life just goes to hell after that, blindsided me. I don't think I've ever been so struck by a performance. And I tried to find out more about her. It was the mid-90s, and you know, I was in my early 20s and didn't really know anything about research. And I tried to find out more about her and kind of came up empty-handed. And then very soon, I saw her in Scarface, the original Scarface with Paul Muni. There was an original one. And then a movie she made with James Cagney called G-Men. And then I was sunk. I was just so interested in knowing why this woman who was beautiful and talented, why she wasn't a huge star. And what I eventually realized was that I could afford to collect vintage movie posters from her films.
Wow.
And I've been a compulsive collector since I was a kid as well. And so nobody collected on Anne. And her movies, for the most part, aren't super notable. So even though I was a starving college student, I could afford to collect these gorgeous 1930s movie posters. And then I just eventually came to the conclusion, well, gosh, if nobody is going to write a book on this person, I guess I should be the one to do it.
And it's a fascinating story, but as you write at the end of the book, her timing was always premature and her efforts seldom beneficial.
Yeah.
And that sort of sums up her career. But let's talk about it. She was born not as Anne Dvorak, but as Anne McKim. And where was she born? Especially, let's talk about her mother.
Yeah, well, she was born in New York City. So she wasn't one of these, you know, actresses that came from the Midwest and journeyed to Hollywood. She was born into entertainment. Her father was a stage performer, started off in legitimate stage, moved on to vaudeville, eventually was a film director. And her mother was also a stage actress who eventually had, a decent film career for about 10 years in the silent era. And I think her mom's career was very similar to Anne's. And her mom had a tremendous amount of influence over her. You know, at one point, she left Anne with relatives in New York so she could pursue the film career in Los Angeles. And so Anne would go see her mom on the big screen in New York. So she's a little girl, and her contact with her mother was seeing her on the movie screens. So that had a huge impact on her, and her parents were divorced. And her mother, when they were ultimately reunited and her mom kind of abandoned the film career, her mom had a lot of influence over her and loved her. But when Anne started exhibiting a desire to become a film actress herself, her mom thought she wasn't, like, attractive enough or vibrant enough.
Yeah, nice mother.
It didn't really encourage her to pursue films. But once Anne, you know, started to make a name for herself, her mom was just thrilled and loved kind of this resumption in the spotlight.
Now, her film debut was as a 4-year-old?
Yeah. She was in
Ramona.
The 1916 version of the film Ramona. It was like a 4-reel, epic film. And Anne played the title character in what was called the prologue. And she was 4 years old. And got great notices. Apparently, was very precocious, and the film critics just adored her. But unfortunately, like many silent films, it's lost.
So. What's interesting about her, too, and you write about this, is that she had an early passion for writing.
Yes.
And that stayed with her entire life, right until virtually the end. And later, she actually was interested in script writing.
Yeah, she had, I think she always kind of grappled between being an actress and being a writer. And she actually, after she graduated from high school, tried to get a job as a newspaper writer, but she was 16, so nobody really wanted to hire her. She claimed she was a cub reporter with the LA Times. I was never able to substantiate that or not. but all through her life, she was going to write, about her travels. She was going to write, she supposedly wrote a play about her parents in vaudeville. During the war, she went to England and was a war correspondent and actually did write some articles and identified with herself as being more a journalist than an actress at that time. Even at the very end of her life, she was, I found, like, ads that she was going to place in the Hollywood Reporter, like, advertising herself as a couchside critic, and apparently was going to go interview people on the set of Hawaii Five-0 because she was living in Hawaii.
Now, she starts out as one of the chorus members, but as you talk about in the book, she was always energetic. You could always pick her up. She was also really suntanned.
Yes.
She really stood out, and I'm thinking about movies like The Hollywood Review of 1929, which was just on TCM like a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And that, by the way, that was the first time that Singing in the Rain appears on film is in that movie.
Yeah.
But she sort of is in several of those films. She becomes an assistant choreographer. Why did she change her name? And why did she change her name to Dvorak, which is going to be the worst name change in the world?
Why did she pick something? Well, when her name, as you mentioned, was Anna McKim. And when she went to work as a chorus girl at MGM, she actually gave them her mother's name, Anna Lair. So she was initially known as Anna Lair at the MGM studio. And I think she wanted to when she wanted to break out of the chorus and got sick of it, I think she changed the name to Dvorak to make herself sound more sophisticated. Over the years, she would claim that Dvorak was a name on her mother's side of the family, which her mother was Czech. And I did a little bit of genealogy. I was never actually able to pinpoint the name Dvorak. Her father later told someone she just thought it sounded classy and named herself after the composer. But that was what she picked. And I don't think anybody ever knew how to pronounce it properly. She was, referred to as like the girl whose name sounded like a typographical error. And, sometimes columnists would say that she had been stripped of her foreign accent very nicely. Even
right.
She never actually had a foreign accent.
She was really hardworking, though. And from the get-go, she had a really strong work ethic. She really worked hard and gave it her all, even in minor film roles.
She always did, like her entire life. Starting off when she was she went to a private school, and at one point her parents couldn't afford it anymore. So she actually, they agreed to let her get to work really early in the morning to answer phones and help in the office. And that carried her through. And even once she became an actress at Warner Brothers and got placed in a lot of really lousy roles, just kind of throwaway pictures and, leading lady roles, I think she always gave it her all. I think you could always tell she was giving more to the part, even if the part didn't necessarily deserve to have that much given to it.
Now, she had an early friendship that she developed with Joan Crawford, too, right?
She did. When she was at MGM, Joan Crawford really took a shine to her. And started and really tried to help her break out of the chorus and get into more substantial roles. And people on the lot would refer to Anne as the chorus girl who looks like Joan Crawford. And apparently, Joan didn't mind and didn't feel threatened. But her influence at MGM at the time, this was around 1930, 31, I guess, just really didn't extend too far because she was able to get Anne as an extra in a couple of the films, but was never able to get her anything more substantial than that. And I don't know if they really maintained a very close friendship. I think they would see each other sometimes, although at the end of her life, Anne's Christmas card list did include the names of Joan Crawford's kids. So I think they might have maintained some sort of contact.
Now, Scarface is a big breakthrough film, and the role of
Cesca Camonte.
Yeah, that is an amazing film. Howard Hawks directs.
Mm-hmm.
And then she starts being hailed as Hollywood's new Cinderella. And you talk about her physical transformation in that film, too. It was major.
It was. You look at pictures of her at MGM, or you see her in the MGM chorus, and she's cute. As you mentioned, she's really exuberant and enthusiastic, and she has this goofy, lopsided smile. But she looks like a teenager. She's very unpolished. She kind of has, kind of thick eyebrows for the time period. And then she gets the role of Cheska and is given that movie star transformation. And it's amazing how she goes from, kind of a sweet but goofy-looking teenager to just this kind of sophisticated, exotic beauty. And it's really just amazing. I have, I have a presentation that I do about the book, and I put a picture of her from, probably early 1931 next to a photo of her from late 1931 as Cheska. And it's amazing how different she looks.
Now, This is where the story starts to get really complicated, because now you sort of feel like she's primed for the big career. The Hollywood press is really building her up. And then she develops an interesting relationship with Howard Hughes. And this is where the whole contract thing gets really complex, but it's interesting. What's her relationship with Howard Hughes and the Cato Company?
Yeah, well, Howard Hughes had his own production company. He produced Hell's Angels and then went on to produce Scarface. And, Howard Hawks was actually the one who cast Anne in Scarface. And so he brought her to Howard Hughes' attention, and Hughes just immediately signed her up for a long-term contract. And it was kind of like the standard 7-year contract with options, where she would make so much a week and it would gradually be increased. And so, he had also had Jean Harlow under contract. So this wasn't a new thing for him, to find these young actresses and kind of take them under his wing. So it looked like she was going to have this career with Howard Hughes. And then Warner Brothers ends up becoming just completely infatuated with her. She actually only made 2 movies for Howard Hughes, Scarface and Sky Devils. And Warner Brothers launches into an exclusive arrangement with him where they borrowed her for 6 months to just put her in Warner Brothers films. And he was fine making he didn't have anything lined up for her. And then he ultimately sold her contract. So she only made 2 movies with him. And then, he sold her contract for $40,000, which was actually $10,000 more than what he sold Jean Harlow's contract to MGM for. So I think it's interesting that Anne was considered more of a bet than Jean Harlow in 1932.
Now, she makes films like The Strange Love of Molly Louvain, 3 in a Match. She gets to 1932, and this is where things go terribly awry. She develops a relationship with this Leslie Fenton, and you got to talk about who he is and his influence over her, because this is really fascinating.
It's fascinating, and depending on how you look at it, unfortunate. Desperately wants to be in films. So she's been in the chorus and working towards it and just really wanted, I don't know that she wanted to be like a famous movie star, but she really wanted to be an actress. It was something she set her sights on, and she's getting it. She's cast in Scarface, she's getting all of this press, and then, she does Molly Louvain, and her co-star is Leslie Fenton, and he's 10 years older than her. He's also an actor. But he's someone who viewed Hollywood as a way to make a lot of money really quickly, that he could then just go travel around Europe and just spend all the money until it was gone, and then come back and make more money. And that was his view towards Hollywood, whereas Anne viewed it, more as a career, and her mom definitely viewed Hollywood as a career for Anne. And she falls, just madly, passionately in love, the way only like a 20-year-old can fall in love, just head over heels with Leslie Fenton. And within a matter of weeks, they elope. And within a couple of months, he convinces her that they should go see the world. And so she walks out on her Warner Brothers contract. This was after they had purchased it from Howard Hughes. And they go on an 8-month honeymoon all around Europe. And it's, an incredible experience that she carries with her entire life, but it essentially torpedoes the trajectory of her career.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Christina Rice, a librarian writer. She oversees the photo collection at the Central Library in downtown Los Angeles and has written an amazing biography, Anne Dvorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel. What happens is, first of all, one of the things you don't do is sort of get Jack Warner on your bad side.
No, I don't advise that at all.
Well, and people say, what I love this is people were talking about, did she pull a Cagney? Now, what does that mean?
Yeah, because, you know, Cagney in 1931 breaks out with The Public Enemy and becomes, like, just a huge star and a huge box office draw. And he immediately starts to become discontented with this contract that he had signed and with the pay that he was given. He felt he was making a lot of money for the studio and that he deserved more. And so, you know, he would walk out on his contract and get suspended and was fighting them. And so when Anne, after she married Leslie Fenton, and there were rumors that she was going to take off, that's what people were referencing, was she pulling a Cagney. At that point in her career, you know, it wasn't really advised because she wasn't the box office draw that Cagney was. No. And when she walked out on her, you know, she essentially walked out on her contract because she was 20 years old and madly in love and wanted to go see Europe. But I think as a way, I think she did feel a little bit guilty about that. Like, it's in character for Anne to have had definitely a twinge of guilt and second-guessing herself. And so what she ended up doing was going to the press and complaining about her salary and that, you know, the little kid who played her son in Three on a Match made as much as she did.
Right.
And how producers were slave drivers. So it kind of came off like she was pulling a Cagney and complaining about her contract. But essentially, you know, I think her agent and her husband were telling her to say that as a way to justify really just wanting to go to Europe.
Well, she comes – the weird thing for me is that she comes back from Europe and Warner Brothers sort of lets her back on the lot.
Oh yeah, they absolutely. You know, they had spent $40,000 for her contract. They wanted to, you know, make some money off of her. So, you know, they certainly had no intentions of really promoting her and putting her in starring roles. But I think they definitely wanted to try to, you know, get some of the money back. So, you know, even after she comes back, she works with them until late 1936. And, you know, and I get the impression that Jack Warner really liked her. I think he liked her. I think he had a lot of hope for her. Thought she had a lot of talent, but just, you know, he wasn't the type that could get over being slighted the way she did.
Now, what kind of roles were she given after she got back?
Yeah, for the most part, like pretty boring roles, like leading lady roles where she would just be like the devoted girlfriend trying to prop up the leading man. You know, occasionally she might get, you know, something a little bit better. There's Housewife, which she stars in with Bette Davis. There's Heat Lightning, which is a great pre-code film with Aileen McMahon. And mm-hmm. she plays the kid's sister, and it's a second-tier role, but it's a little bit more interesting. But for the most part, you know, yeah, pretty boring movies that she does try to do, you know, a lot with them, but can only go so far.
And the other thing is she's living a very interesting private life with Leslie. They're out on a ranch. They basically don't socialize an awful lot. She develops an interest in bacteriology. I mean, this is a very strange biography, but you know, that's not playing the Hollywood game either.
No, and that was, I think can be squarely placed on Leslie Benton's shoulders. You know, I think you see Anne as a chorus girl, and she's spending her days at the beach, and she's talking about how much she just wants to go out dancing. And, you know, I think she was a very, you know, social, you know, sweet, bright person. And Leslie Fenton just isn't. You know, he's kind of a brooding person, and even though he's working in Hollywood, he has a lot of resentment towards it. And so he and Anne buy a ranch out in the San Fernando Valley, which, you know, a lot of, like, Clark Gable had a ranch in Al Jolson. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, they really become pretty consumed with that ranch life. They have a 36-acre walnut ranch, and they have their library and their books and their microscopes to study bacteriology. you know, and they did socialize a bit. Like, I have photos of them. You know, they would go to the boxing matches every week in Hollywood, and they would go hang out at the Brown Derby. I think by Hollywood standards, though, they were considered pretty reclusive, and she definitely gets wrapped up in this life that Leslie Fenton wanted.
And then there's finally a huge lawsuit with Warner Brothers and the whole determination whether she was in a breach of contract. And you know, she finally earns total career freedom.
She did. You know, and that's where the title Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel for me really comes from, is that lawsuit. In 1936, James Cagney and Bette Davis, who are both with Warner Brothers, filed lawsuits against Warner Brothers to, you know, for breach of contract or to get out of their contracts. And their cases, you know, get mentioned frequently, you know, for those of us who are, you know, film fanatics and read up on it a lot. Their cases get mentioned often. Anne filed her lawsuit against Warner Brothers for breach of contract before either Cagney or Davis
right.
did. And her lawsuit seldom, if ever, gets mentioned. And I honestly believe that her actions really paved the way for Cagney and Davis, because Cagney filed his lawsuit a couple of months after Ames. And, you know, she wasn't successful. She had some sort of mysterious illness, and she was also irritated with the roles she was getting and was put on an indefinite suspension. So that was what caused her to file the lawsuit. And she did lose it, so she didn't actually win the lawsuit. And eventually, I think Jack Warner kept her under contract long enough to make his point and then said, fine, let her go. Who cares? But she was one of the earlier, you know, contract players to take a studio to court, and I think she definitely needs to be recognized for that.
Absolutely.
Her efforts weren't successful.
After that, she was often in sort of not so great films and or had small roles or both. What was fascinating for me is her during World War II, though, because
World War II ended up actually being my favorite part of writing the book. So yeah, so she ends up becoming a freelancer, which is what she wanted, and it's questionable how well that went. But Leslie Fenton, even though he had, you know, grown up in the United States, was actually a British citizen. So when England became involved in the war, he enlisted in the Royal Navy and went over there. That was in September of 1940, and Anne couldn't bear to be away from him.
Right.
And so she just started doing whatever she could to get over there, and finally was able to get a British passport as a British citizen, being married to a British citizen. And so the first time Anne is ever on her own taking care of herself is on a freighter ship traveling through hostile waters, being stranded in Lisbon for a month until she can get passage to London, and she flies into London during the Blitz. And that's the first time she's ever on her own.
It's amazing what she does during the course of the war, too. She's a correspondent, ambulance driver, farmer, film actress, and a camp show performer.
Yeah, she
does it all.
She does it all. Like, she really, I think the chapter's called Anne of All Trades.
Yeah.
She really does it all.
Now, what happens after the war, though?
So after the war, Leslie Fenton gets injured in the Battle of St. Nazaire. So they actually come back to the States in 1943. You know, and here's this couple that has literally been to hell and back together. And the war just has this adverse effect on their marriage. I don't know if it's just that Anne comes into her own during the war, but the marriage actually dissolves. And in 1946, they get divorced.
Now, is she still in movies? In other words, is she still getting film roles at all? What does she do instead?
Yeah, when she comes back, it takes a while, and she finally, like, her first film when she comes back is a film called Flame of Barbary Coast with John Wayne. So it's Republic Pictures, which isn't as big a studio as Warner Brothers, but it was still a pretty big production. So she kind of starts off, you know, her post-war career with a bang. And then, for whatever reason, it just kind of, you know, she again starts getting these kind of second-tier roles in independent productions. So, you know, she never, you know, and then she gets married again to a dancer and starts focusing on her marriage once again. So, you know, anytime her career picks up a little bit of momentum, she seems to get distracted, and it never recovers.
And the second marriage is a disaster.
Yeah, it's not. I kind of look at the second marriage as the party marriage. You know, as Leslie Fenton, you know, this serious, studious guy that was 10 years older, and Igor, her second husband, was 4 years younger. He was a dancer, so his job was performing in nightclubs. He had a full head of hair, so it lasted 4 years. It wasn't great, but I hope she had fun. I think she did.
In the end, she moves to Hawaii, and we only have a few minutes left, and I want to talk about her passing because it was covered really horribly in the tabloids, the way they describe it. So I want you to address that.
Yeah. So she ultimately moves to Hawaii. So she gets married a third time to a guy named Nicholas Wade, who his niece described him as a sociopath. He was pretty awful.
Jesus.
He was physically abusive, mentally abusive, and spent all her money. So any money she had made as an actress with real estate investments is gone by the end. And so when she died, after she died in 79, the National Enquirer ran this brutal article about how she was, like, living in poverty and squalor and was half crazy. She definitely was living on a fixed income. You know, she had her SAG pension. She was getting rent subsidy, maybe on food stamps. So it definitely wasn't great. But, you know, she wasn't living in squalor. I mean, she was living in Waikiki Beach in this area where, I think, like, a lot of, like, the surfers and drug addicts might have been hanging out. But, you know, what I discovered is that she was still Anne. You know, as I mentioned before, she
right.
was, you know, trying to fashion herself as a couchside critic, hoping to write for TV Guide or The Hollywood Reporter, and she had created some sort of, you know, solvent to help cotton farmers and was trying to market it. And so she wasn't, you know, the tabloids made it sound like she was just kind of sitting around waiting to die, and she wasn't. Like, she was still Anne. She was still Anne Dvorak, and even though she wasn't making movies, that wonderful, bizarre mind of hers was still very active.
She also wrote A Complete History of the World that she recorded.
She did. In the 60s, she wrote an 18-volume abridged history of the world, which she called Historical Digest, and she made an audiobook of it. And her goal was to promote it to universities as a teaching aid. And, you know, I think it sounds perfectly logical now, and there are things like that exist. We have things like that at the library I work at, people check out all the time. But in 1969, that was really far out, and so nobody was willing to give Historical Digest a chance, so it didn't go anywhere.
We were talking about there's no copy of that left as far as we know.
Well, I mean, I haven't found a copy. You know, right after I finished the book earlier in it, last year, this very mysterious person contacted me who had a bunch of Anne's stuff from right around from when she died, including her scrapbook of photos from the honeymoon. And this person was very troubled and was very difficult to deal with. And she referenced that her friend in his van had more Anne Dvorak stuff. It's very, very cryptic. And
whoa,
I wasn't able to get
whoa.
Her again. So that is my secret desire, that in a van somewhere in Reno, in a box, is Historical Digest. So I've not given up hope that I might find a copy of it one day.
I so want to hear that. I so want to hear that. First of all, it's narrated
by... I hope it's not terrible.
Well, that actually doesn't matter. It's narrated by her, right?
Yeah.
Can you imagine? It's going to be great.
My wildest dream.
Okay, we just have a minute left. If you were to name three movies for the listener to see her at her best, and I know what these are going to be, but I want you to repeat them anyways. What would
Scarface,
be the three movies?
Yeah, definitely Scarface, Three on a Match, and Strange Love of Molly Louvain.
Fantastic.
And all three of those are available on DVD.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
My guest tonight has been Christina Rice, librarian and writer. She oversees the photo collection at the Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Great job. And we are talking about her book, and what a fascinating and different biography it is. Anne Dvorak, Hollywood's Forgotten Rebel. Thank you so much for your time, Christina.
Great. Thank you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.